It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome to this episode of Kennedy Saves the World. There are a very special few number of journalists who save the world in their own right by going to war zones and giving the rest of us the truth, which sometimes can be daunting and difficult. But in the case of my next guest, he almost paid with his life. Two of his colleagues, including one of his best friends whom he had worked with and trusted deeply for years, unfortunately, was killed in the Russian strike on March 14th of last year. You might have heard his story. You've seen him on Fox News. His book is absolutely compelling. It is so well written. It is like a spy novel that really happened. You cannot believe the course of events as it goes from one part of his life to the strike and his recovery, which is so improbable, it almost seems made up, but it's not. Every word is true and worth reading. The book is called Saved, A War Reporter's Mission to Make It Home. Benjamin Hall, welcome to Kennedy Saves the World.
Kennedy, what a pleasure to be with you today.
So I really appreciate in your book how you sort of outline your life and what led you to be a war journalist and your desire for adventure. And you talk about your dad, who was so grateful to make it out alive as a kid, thanks to U.S. servicemen and women, and your mom, who had a very difficult upbringing. So your dad almost seemed like he was running toward adventure, and your mom almost used adventure as a way to escape the trauma from her childhood. How much are either of your parents... How much do their stories enter into you? At what ratio? Are you running toward something or running away from something when you go into these intense environments?
That's so interesting of you to say it that way. And you're spot on. You know, I look at my mother and I think that, you know, from a young age, she ran away from home when she was young. Her father, you know, was abusive to her. Her mother committed suicide, and she was looking for freedom. She wanted to find a better world, another world. And so she set off when she was 16 or so to London and created a new world for herself. And her whole life was about finding and meeting new people, realizing that the world was so much better than the horrors she saw when she was young. And that's what she instilled in me from a very, very young age, traveling wherever we could around the world, meeting people we'd never met, realizing that everyone's got a story and you have to go and learn everyone's story. And sometimes what you see on the surface isn't necessarily what's happening underneath. That's another key part of journalism. And it's something my mother always taught me. My father, on the other hand, well, in many ways, it was similar. He was born in war as well. And he was, you know, in Manila. And they lost everything. Most of his family were killed by the Japanese. That he was in a prisoner camp in Manila for a few years. And he was rescued. He was 12 years old when American GIs from the Buckeye Division, they came in and they pulled him off the streets. They lifted him behind a tank. They raised him, you know, into the sky and they hugged him. And he said that was the moment his life changed. And he realized also there was great freedom out there, despite the horrors that you have seen. And he went on to live his life in the U.S., always gripping at that, always trying to find the freedom and the ability to do what you could. And that's exactly what I have found, both of those. A, from my mother, realizing that you can go out and find incredible stories because the world can be wonderful, even though there are horrors in it. To my father's influence, that was the same. It's that, you know, despite the horrors happening in the world and the wars, there is great things and there are freedom. And so from a young age, I wanted to go and learn more. I wanted to see the world. I wanted to maybe in some way experience what they had experienced. And that's what led me to covering conflicts. Perhaps, you know, I had traveled a lot, but I wanted to experience the real extremes of life. It was more for me than just wanting to go and visit the world. I wanted to really see how people felt. And that's because my parents had told me, you know, of the things that they had gone through. So being a journalist is about discovering things that are new. And that's what I always set out to do. And, you know, it led me to March 14th last year. And in many ways, What happened to me that day was very similar to what happened to my parents. I lost almost everything. I lost my colleagues next to me. I lost limbs. I was badly injured. But I knew, because my parents had told me and taught me, that if I could push through, there was good on the other side. There was light on the other side. There was freedom on the other side. And that's what then drove me every single day to get better and to come home again. So look, I look back at it now and I think, without my parents, without them instilling those morals in me, without them encouraging me, I don't think I would have had the recovery that I had. I don't think I would be sitting here talking to you in such an optimistic way as I am right now.
And that's what strikes me about you, is your optimism. And, you know, I'm wondering how much of that went into your recovery. But first, I want to go back and visit something that happened after the strike, because, you know, you said you heard your daughter's voice. Are you a believer in the supernatural? Do you believe that somehow your daughter was able to communicate with you? You and Pierre, the cameraman, and Sasha, who was your fixer or translator, you had gone out with two Ukrainian soldiers to survey some of the damage in the village of Horenka. And after you were hit, you heard this voice. How real was that?
No, it was as if she was in front of it. And I saw her too. My eyes were closed. The first shell had landed and I was already injured. I knew I got the facial injuries and shrapnel in my eye at that point. And I was out. I was blacked out. And I saw and I heard, in this immense calm, in this silence, this peaceful place, my daughter's silent, quiet voice just saying, "Daddy, you've got to get out of the car." I mean, and it was, you say supernatural. I've never thought it was supernatural, but it was another place. It was a world where I was always on death's door and I was close to the end. And I was pulled back from that moment. You know, and I don't think it was supernatural in the sense that my daughter came to me, but I do think that it was God or someone, you know, a power. God sent me the one thing that would open my eyes and get me out and give me that motivation and give me the power to get out. And that was my family and my daughters. And so, again, it all comes back down to family. And that's what happened that day. And I feel that every single day now. I feel this immense physical emotion towards my daughters and my wife that I didn't quite before. I mean, I physically feel it. And I know that something changed that day. And I ask myself every day about God and, you know, angels and what it was that came to save me that day. Because the people I was with, Pierre and Sasha, the two Ukrainians, they were around me. I mean, I was in the middle death seat. It is remarkable, almost unbelievable, that I survived and the others died. And I ask myself every day why that was. And then I think doesn't help too much to worry or think about it. What is more important is making sure that you grab every day, you do as best you can, you help others. And that's how I choose to remember it and to channel it.
Yes. And you had something within you. And, you know, we all think that we encounter difficulties, you know, when you lose a job or you're in the middle of a fitness class and you want to give up and you think this is really hard, but that's really nothing. And I don't know what prepares you for you pulling yourself out of the car and then looking down, seeing that part of your leg had been blown off and you were bleeding badly. You knew you were bleeding out of your eye. You could see blood on your hands. You clawed your way up an embankment and started throwing dirt at a car. And it took every ounce of emotional and physical energy that you have. And it was so beautifully described in your book. Had you ever felt anything like that need to survive before?
No, I hadn't, but I had often asked myself how I would react in a situation like that. I've been to many wars and I've seen people injured like that. I've watched people take their last breaths and I always wondered what would it be like. You know, I've seen people, you know, shot and children burnt and all of it. And I always wondered how would I get through it? And
is it different than you imagined?
It was more automatic than I imagined. I never at one point did I say, "Oh, look, this is awful," or "God, what am I going to do?" Or, you know, it was all the first second it happened. It was right. Okay, I'm going to crawl that way. I've got to find help. I've got to go home. I never thought about my injuries that much. I just knew that I had to be saved. And that's where all my energy went, everything, laser focused, staying alive. You're going home. However it is, you're going home and you'll find a way. And maybe I was lucky because I was able to channel the fear. I never got afraid. I never worried that I was going to die. I just channeled it into finding a way back to my family. So maybe that's how I got through it. But the same happened every single day of the recovery. And you talk about difficult times, like if you're in a, you know, you lose a job or things don't go well, and you still have to find a way to channel positive energy. And I still get annoyed at small things in my day, but the same thing happens. You just, and when I was going through operations and it was very painful during the recovery, I had to do the same thing. Recenter, it's okay. This is going to pass and you're going to keep going. And I do that whether it's a small thing or whether it was the worst thing. I just focus on the same thing. Let's find a way through it. Just get a way through it and it'll be okay.
We have more of this interview in moments coming up.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And you had so many challenges. So, you know, people listening to the story might think, oh, that's horrible, but he was rescued by a Ukrainian soldier named Song. He was thrown into the back of an ambulance or the back of a van and then transferred by an ambulance at a checkpoint to a hospital, and he was operated on. But that was only the beginning. Then Jen Griffin, and I saw her recently, and I told her how deeply moved I was at her part in your story and contacting Sarah Verardo from Save Our Allies and getting a team who leapt into action because, you know, she talked to John Kirby, who is the spokesperson for the Security Council. I know I'm going to get that wrong. The Rear Admiral. He's on Fox all the time. See him. He's a great communicator. But she was like, we need to get Benjamin Hall out of Ukraine. And he said, we can't. U.S. forces cannot go into Ukraine. Once he gets to Poland, we can take care of him. And then she spoke with Sarah Verardo, who then talked to the most mysterious man in the entire book, Seaspray, who is the most phenomenally interesting character I think I've ever read about. And once you get to the Seaspray part, it's not as though the book wasn't compelling before. It's wild. But you cannot put the book down. Tell me about Seaspray.
You know, it's one of those moments where you realize just how incredible American heroes are and the things they can do around the world. And Seaspray is one of them. And he has served across the U.S. military and government in other ways. And now he is out there. And just in my case, he came in to save me. I was an American. I was injured. And he came in. And he is an expert at extracting people around the world. And he's done it in all corners of the world. And he goes in and he analyzes everything in a heartbeat. He's looking at possible escape routes. He's contacting all intelligence services. He's speaking to the doctors. He wants to know the vehicles on the way out.
He's buying ambulances.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing all of it. And he is putting this together while he's on the road in the middle of the night, driving in from Poland for a 24-hour journey to find me. You know, he's getting license plates. He's getting CCTV images checked out if he can find them. And Seaspray just came in. He totally took control of the situation. He came in. They had to kind of pretend to be doctors. They needed to get me out of Ukraine, but there was no way to get me safely out. I had a big matchbox-sized pieces of shrapnel in my neck, which they couldn't take out.
Not to mention the drain in your head. And, you know, a recent amputation, and you were burned over, what, 20% of your body?
Yeah, everything from the waist down, skin was all gone. I mean, it was a really terrible situation. And, you know, getting me out was going to be tough because they couldn't drive me out. The roads were bad and they couldn't get out of a 25-hour car ride. They couldn't fly me out because they were worried of surface-to-air missiles and the Russians attacking, because the Russians at this point were only 20 miles away and surrounding the city we were in. And amazingly, because of Seaspray's connections and because of the contacts he has and because some other American heroes in Poland who dealt with, you know, who were in the government but who helped out, they found out that the Polish prime minister, of all people, was on the very first secret mission visit to see Zelensky. And he had come in his train in the middle of the night. And if we could break through the checkpoints in the middle of the night, we could go out with the Polish prime minister. And so we just had an incredible array of people.
But they you get on the train, they don't even have a gurney for you. You are so unstable at this point. They have to take you into the train on a dirty blanket.
Yeah, one of the toughest moments, because they didn't have any pain meds for me either. Oh. They did the operation and then the pain meds were gone. And so as we were driving in the middle of the night towards the train station, every checkpoint was opening up the ambulance and opening up my wounds. They thought like we were the Russian hit squad coming in to get Zelensky, and there was a total curfew. So there we were breaking curfew and out the guns right at us every single checkpoint. And the pain started to mount. It started to mount. And as I got to the train was when it really started to kick in, and they carried me on board. And it was just a simple focus in my mind that it didn't matter how I felt. These guys were saving me and I had to put the pain behind me. But I lay on that train for 10 hours. And my mind at this point, I had a traumatic brain injury. My mind wouldn't stop thinking. It was on hyperdrive. And I had a new second, I had probably 10 thoughts a second, nonstop for 10 hours all over the world and the place. And I'm just thinking, I got to stay together. I got to keep this pain down. These guys are here to save me, and I want to be part of the team too. I don't want them to be worrying about me. You know, that makes this mission harder. They need to be worrying about the way out, and all I have to do is just lie here in silence and just keep my head and let them do what they do best. And that's how I thought about all of it, and that's how I thought about the recovery later as well. We were on a team. It was me as part of a big team. And if you work together, both in this recovery but also in life, then we do good things. We do great things. And that's what you do. You work together and good things happen.
Yeah. And people can learn so much about overcoming from your book and, you know, how this incredible optimism that was ingrained in you. But also you were screwing around with a voodoo doll in the middle of a jungle with a drunken shaman. Do you think that has had any impact on your life?
It's funny because I was in Haiti just after the earthquake. What year that was? 15 years ago or so, perhaps. But everyone was doing stories about, and I was a freelance journalist, and everyone was doing stories about the atrocities. And I thought, well, no one's buying my stories right now. I had to go and tell a story that no one else is selling. So I headed deep into the jungle in the south of Haiti, and I went to find the voodoos and wanted to see how voodoo ceremonies and were perhaps trying to motivate people to get better and to save their country. And I ended up going through some voodoo ceremonies and being baptized as a voodoo and had a voodoo doll put together. And they did ask, they did say, we're doing the ceremony. What is it that you want? What is it you want? And, you know, but my heart sank and I felt, I don't believe in voodooism. I believe in God, but I still was nervous doing it. And I said at the time, I want to get to the top of my career. I want to reach the very top. And I kind of made that pact. And then we tied up this voodoo doll, and I have to say I've still got that voodoo doll.
Really?
And I think back on it, I've still got the voodoo doll. And I think back sometimes and I wonder, did I put myself on the line? Did I risk something because I wanted something which at the time felt important, like getting to the top of my career, but I was a young journalist.
You had met your wife, Alicia. You met her when you were six. You guys went to school together, which is so cute. But you were unattached at that point and ambitious and driven. So all of that is understandable, but it is remarkable how your focus has shifted. You know, it's like when you have kids, and people who have kids understand this, it changes your focus and direction and your feelings and your heart, and you connect with things that make you incredibly vulnerable. But it also gives you a superpower at the same time. And I think I was most moved in your book reading about your children and, you know, even carrying their three tiny stuffed animals, the hedgehogs, in under your bulletproof vest, like and giving one of them to a little girl who was in the hospital, I believe the day that you almost died, and you gave her one of those because she had seen her mother slaughtered.
Yeah, a couple of days before, that's right. We were in hospital, Pierre and I together, and it was an interesting day because this girl was the same age as my eldest, and she had her leg was almost gone. Her mother had just been killed in front of her, and it was the first time that I felt this incredible pang. You know, that if that was my daughter, just how would I feel? What would that be like? And you realize the atrocities that happen in war. But I mean, my children mean everything to me. And, you know, there was a bit of a debate at first. I remember when I had the first daughter, and I was actually in Iraq when I found out that my wife was pregnant. And the discussion started with my wife, which was, you know, do I need to pull back from going to war zones? I've got children now. I think we need to be a bit more sensible about it. And, well, I pulled back a little bit, but I didn't altogether. And that was, you know, you had to balance that thing. I felt the job I was doing was so important, and it was what I loved doing. And I tried to pull back from the front lines, and I continued covering conflicts from a little bit further back. But there was a battle in my own life at that point to figure out what was most important. And was it just being with my family, or was it doing the work I loved and thought was needed to be done? So it was always an interesting debate in my mind. And I never think I made the wrong decision. You know, I think the job we did was absolutely essential. And I want my daughters to understand that in life, you got to go and find something you love doing, and you got to love your family, but you got to, working hard is important too.
Yes. And the careers that are most worth doing are the most competitive. So you have to work even harder than everybody else to be successful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Or get 100%. A good voodoo doll.
New home. That's working fine for me.
So let me ask you about humor, because, you know, we talk about your spirit, which is just, I mean, I think you had such a strong mental and emotional compartment that you were carrying around that shielded you and propelled you through all of these things. But what about humor? Like, when did you start to laugh inappropriately at things?
Straight away. I, at no point did I go through, you know, I think I care a lot about how others feel, to the point that I don't want to upset anyone. And I've always lived my life that way. Like, me not being myself or not being funny or having humor or being able to laugh with someone, well, that just didn't seem fair on people around me. And I suppose I didn't want that to happen, but I felt that humor is important. It's been important throughout this. And humor, by the way, between people who have lost limbs, I mean, is big. We joke all the time. Like, there's no one else that you can joke with, but whenever I see someone who's lost limbs, veterans, there's always jokes. You got to laugh at it, or else you take it too seriously. And I think it's when you take things really seriously that they become problems in your mind. So, you know, you laugh things off and you say, well, yeah, that won't happen again. Let's keep going.
We have more of this interview in moments coming up. What about Huckleberry? He was one of the therapy dogs, because after Poland, you went to Landstuhl in Germany, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. And then you ended up at Bamsey in the beautiful state of Texas.
Yeah. I mean, it was the best place to go, and that's because it was a center that was set up at Brook Army Medical Center in San Antonio, and it was set up to deal with patients like me, polytrauma. That is what happens when you get blown up. Limb loss, often eyesight loss, burns. And in one place, they take care of you. And one of the ways they do that too is that they have therapy dogs who come in sometimes. So you do the hard stuff every single day.
I mean, your hard stuff was like, it was like 6 or 8 hours a day. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
it's like,
it was nonstop.
I had hip surgery in November, and I would do physical therapy for an hour a couple times a week. And I thought that was hard. But going through what you were going through, like strengthening your core and having to figure out how to use prosthetics and, you know, whether or not you should keep your other foot, and having to deal with all of that, manage pain, ongoing surgeries, your body is burned. I mean, the amount of focus that goes into the physical therapy alone was staggering.
That's what you're there to do. And every single second is about getting better. You know, in life, you've got distractions. I feel that in hospital, it's one of the simplest places to be. You've got one thing to do, and that's all you do. That's all you focus on. And whatever you did the day before, you've got to do more the day after. Every single day, you keep going. And that becomes your absolute focus. And, you know, you're doing it together in a team, and you work on every single muscle and every single finger. You know, my left hand was blown up, and my thumb was basically torn off. They patched it back together with my hip bone and they put my elbow over it. And but, you know, I had to learn to move my fingers again. And that's, you know, every day. That was one example. Move that one little finger, move that one finger, move that one little bit more. You know, at first I couldn't move at all. My muscle atrophied and it was move that left leg up a centimeter, just lift it off the bed a centimeter. That's all I could move. They would do it 2 centimeters every single day. And you mentioned Huckleberry the dog. Well, that was the moment. It was a really emotional day because I'd probably been in hospital at that point, ICU for about 2 months, you know, so really bad. But I'd just been coming out of that. And in came Huckleberry, this dog, and he dropped a ball, a tennis ball, at my feet. I was in a wheelchair at that point. And I picked it up, I threw it, and he brought it back to me, and I just burst into tears. I couldn't stop crying. It was that one moment, that one reminder of my own dog who would have done the same, and that I'm one step closer. I remembered what life was like outside. I remembered some of the things that I enjoyed, and I didn't appreciate how great Huckleberry could be. And it felt like a connection to the outside world. And Huckleberry would come up every day and I just remember just give him a hug. But that's what recovery is about. You know, you're so focused on what you do and how you are recovering, but then you have to start thinking about going back into the real world. And that was one of the more terrifying things for me. I knew I could operate in hospital. I knew I could walk a little bit, but I was afraid of going back into the real world and having to deal with all these other issues. And my family having to get used to me. And so that was the transition that I watched the most. How am I going to prepare for my current injuries, but in the real world? And to be honest, that has been the hardest part. In hospital was one thing. Getting saved and evacuated was one thing. But learning to live, find your normal life when you've got all these injuries, that's quite difficult. A lot of things that I used to do, I can't do. And that's okay. It's just learning how to do other things, find other things to do. So it's like learning your life again. And that can be difficult at times. And not just for me, but for my wife, who I always have to talk about. You know, Alicia, she is doing this every step of the way with me. And it's a new life for her. And she's never for a second, not a single second, shown any regret, any anger, anything at all. It has been, what are we doing today? How are we getting through it? You got a problem? Let's find a way around it. And been blessed, just totally blessed to have her. But yeah, it has been harder in the real world than it was in hospital. That's certain.
And, you know, part of your recovery was them, I think, throwing a 20-pound bag at you to replicate what it would be like one of your daughters jumping into your arms while you were in your prosthetic, your robot leg, so you could catch one of them.
Well, that's because all I was thinking about for the last month was I'm going to walk into my door and I'll see my daughters for the first time. And I know they will run and jump at me. So the worst thing is if they jump and I go flying over. So we had this, we prepared and they were throwing these big bags at me and I was catching them and holding them well. And sure enough, in I walked and there, that's what they did. They came running up, grabbed my legs.
Did you immediately felt reconnected with your life?
Yes. I mean, at that point, all I could think about was that reunion. There wasn't a single other thought than me and my children together again. Like that purest moment where nothing else mattered except you were able to hold them. Nothing mattered. And then, you know, after that, then I was teaching them as well, teaching the children how to, you know, my injuries and the differences. And been blessed that they have been able to do that every step of the way. And I don't think have been, they talk, my youngest, who is 3, she talks about it every day. And she always tells me, she always says, it was the Russians, those Russians. And I'd say, it's not all Russian. Like some Russians are okay. It's not all Russians, but she's only 3. And she's the one that has strong views about the Russians.
Well, good for her, because she'll want to tell the truth about the world as well. So, you know, the family need for adventure, truth, and freedom certainly marches on. And, you know, I love how you describe how you and your wife, you don't hide anything from your daughters. You know, you don't close the door when you're dealing with your prosthetics, and you are very open. And, you know, I think that is healthy. And I think, you know, the story that you have told helps so many people who try and hide their experiences and their pain from not only the world, but from themselves. But you,
yeah,
you are a broadcaster, you are a storyteller. How does your broadcasting career change with the changes in your life?
Well, one of the most incredible things is how many people reach out to me every day on social media and someone will say, look, I've just read your book and I just wanted to say I've been having troubles. I've got some injury or, you know, a family death. Across the board, a whole lot of them. And they write to me and they say, look, reading your story has given me hope and optimism. And I felt that today, even though it was difficult yesterday, I got up today with an extra spring in my step. And I want to thank you. And what a wonderful thing that is that I've been given, that if I can inspire some people to get through difficult moments, then I'm absolutely, you know, that's the one thing I wanted to do. And I look ahead as a journalist and as a broadcaster, and that's also what I want to do. And we're talking at the moment at Fox about starting to look at telling really hopeful, optimistic stories. And I'm going to go out and tell these stories, the people who bring communities together, people like Sea Spray. And so, you know, I've covered wars and I've told the stories of wars for 15 years. And now for the first time, I want to tell the stories of the incredible positive people out there. And that's been a big shift for me. And I want to keep doing it. You mentioned adventure earlier as well. And the thing that came to mind is that this is an adventure. And I went to look for an adventure when I was young. Well, I just see this as an adventure. And it's for adventure for me and my children. And it might not be easy, but finding a way through it is rewarding. And you can't ask for a better thing in life than feeling gratitude and for feeling that you've done something that's difficult. That's like the most rewarding thing. And I get to feel that every day. So in a sense, you know, if you're pleased with the feeling rewarded, well, I'm in a lucky place. And that's how I try to teach my children as well. But life is great. It moves on. I want to work. Broadcasting is something I love doing. Telling stories is something I love doing. My children and I now sit down at least a few times a week and pretend that we're on the news. And I have them tell stories about the people they've met. And so we've got a whole little series going on together about them telling the stories too. So hopefully I can pass it on to them as well.
And there are so many ways to do that. You have shown such an incredible light, not only in war zones, but in triumph. And, you know, the number of people who showed up to help you out and create that spontaneous team, not only in Ukraine, but you know, also in Germany, in Texas, you know, your family back home, your wife's friends. It is a beautiful testament. And the thing that I really appreciate about your book is pity must be so hard for you. Like, that must be such, like, I can tell you're the kind of person who does not want people's pity, but you have neutralized that. And, you know, with your strength and honesty. So I cannot tell you how moved I am by this and how much I admire you, what you've been through. But now, your forward-looking nature and the fact that you are going to save the world in a new way.
I hope so. I really hope so. It's interesting you mentioned pity. It's you meet a whole variety of different people and people react differently to you. You know, they take one look at you and they see your injuries and some don't want to talk about it at all. They look up in the air and they want to talk about weather. Others are really curious and they want to ask about it. Some are slightly afraid and they don't want to say. So most of my life is trying to now make people feel at ease. Not just with me, but with other disabled people, for example. You know, we're totally normal, you know, and touch wood, you know, if you've got your brain and you're able to continue thinking and working, that's one thing, but some don't. But we got to just realize that life has good ups and downs, but it doesn't change the nature of it. And I hope people look at me and they talk to me for a while and they realize that the injuries don't matter. It doesn't change me in any one way. So, yeah.
A robot leg and a spine of steel. Benjamin Hall, everyone should read your book, Saved, A War Reporter's Mission to Make It Home. You made it home. You're making it awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time and being a part of this podcast. I cannot thank you enough.
What a pleasure. Kennedy, maybe I'll see you hopefully in person when I'm next in New York.
I cannot wait. This has been Kennedy Saves the World. I'm Kennedy.
For more podcasts from my friends at Fox, you can go to foxnewspodcast.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. Oh, go ahead and leave me a review while you're there. I'd love to hear what you have to say. You've been listening to Kennedy Saves the World on the Fox News Podcast Network.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.